Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hafa day, yakwe, kum na Māori en halolangeta. This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. On the show today, bodies are washing up on shores of PNG from the recent maritime disaster.
A boy found her. They bring her to the council's residence. They kept her for a night till in the morning, and the chopper went down and got her.
Also, opponents of deep sea mining in American Samoa say there's no way they'll allow their ocean to be used as a testing ground for the controversial industry.
Deep sea mining is not a proven industry, and so any commercial or exploration licenses given out, our waters would be a testing ground. And we really can't afford that because our livelihoods are tied to the ocean.
And Fiji's anti-corruption watchdog is once again at the centre of public debate. All that and more, but before we begin, let's give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I say Faftai Tere Lava, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Now we begin with the first victims of East New Britain's maritime disaster have been found, more than 200 kilometres from where two boats disappeared on Saturday. The province's disaster committee says the bodies of a mother and her 18-year-old daughter washed ashore on Jarl Island in neighbouring New Ireland province on Tuesday. Authorities are investigating reports that more bodies may have been found in the same area as police revise the number of people still missing down to 26. As Natasha Emick reports, coastal communities have come together to mourn the victims of the tragedy.
It's after midnight on Jarl Island, but instead of sleeping, villagers are singing hymns. They're gathered outside a house, keeping vigil beside the body of a woman who washed ashore late on Tuesday night. They don't know her, but they stay with her until morning.
It's sort of a culture, you know. It's a tragedy that when people die, we'll have to do something. So that's what we are doing now.
That was school teacher Michael Rungrung. He was among the islanders who helped recover the first two bodies found on Tuesday. It comes after two boats carrying four families capsized in rough seas off of East New Britain on Saturday. The two women were among 26 people reported missing. Carried by the currents, their bodies drifted more than 200 kilometres northwest across the Bismarck Sea before washing ashore on Jarl Island in the neighbouring New Ireland province. The first was spotted by villagers working in their gardens. The second was found just after midnight by a young boy.
A boy found her. They bring her to the council's residence. They kept her for a night. Since here in Jarl Island, we don't have a network in the night. So they kept her till in the morning, and they rang up to the disaster office. So the chopper went down and got her.
Villagers stayed beside the woman's body, singing hymns until first light. Mr. Rungrung was among the crowd that saw her off the next day, but before the helicopter departed, they placed flowers on her. He says it was a final act of respect for someone they'd never met.
It was really frightening and sad. We couldn't bear with that. So what we are trying to do is to show people that there's a village, Jarl village here, with this type of lifestyle, this type of culture and all that.
The community will continue watching the coastline in case more victims wash ashore. On Wednesday, police said reports of floating bodies continued to come in, particularly around Jarl Island, with authorities sent out in the afternoon to verify those sightings. For Mr. Rung Rung, the tragedy is even harder knowing so many children were among those lost at sea.
They're still in school. They have a long way to go. Looking at the situation here, it's very sad. Like, what will we do?
East New Britain Governor Michael Marram says the compassion showed by the Jarl Island community has brought some much-needed comfort to the grieving families.
Having the body beside them, singing, and it just shows the type of people they are, and also the respect for us as brothers from the region.
He's been speaking with families of the deceased to make sure they continue to get the support they need.
So last night I spoke to the first family at the hospital morgue when they went in and identified the deceased. And then this morning as well, so the administration and this had close communication with the families and also all church leaders here.
He says authorities believe more bodies will be recovered in the coming days.
We're hoping that we have another chopper that was supposed to have been here from PNG police to also be based in Kavieng, so can go along the shores and also have assist us with the Manolos chopper we have right now. So,
Governor Marram is also urging anyone who finds clothing, life jackets or any other debris to report it immediately. Meanwhile, another search is still underway in Bougainville, where three people remain missing after a banana boat disappeared while travelling from Nissen Island to Booker on Saturday, the same day as the incident in East New Britain. The PNG National Weather Service has renewed strong wind warnings across parts of the Bismarck Sea, including Bougainville, East New Britain and New Ireland, with small boats being urged to stay ashore until conditions improve.
And that is reporter Natasha Emick ending that story. Opponents of deep sea mining in American Samoa say there's no way they'll allow their ocean to be used as a testing ground for the controversial industry. The United States government has outlined plans to auction two leases covering large swaths of the ocean floor in its Pacific territory for deep sea mining. Liam Fox reports.
The United States government wants to fast-track deep-sea mining to secure access to critical minerals and weaken China's dominance of the global market. Earlier this year, its Bureau of Ocean Energy Management put out a video outlining the government's viewpoint.
For generations, the ocean has been central to life in America's island territories. It supports food, culture, and local economies. But as needs evolve, these unexplored waters may also contain critical minerals used in technologies people rely on every day.
According to the Bureau, seabed mining is a win-win for the wider economy and for the locals where it'll take place.
Future responsible development could support training opportunities, business activity, and long-term investment in communities. The Department of the Interior also supports pathways to ensure offshore mineral development can provide benefits to territorial governments, including potential revenue sharing.
But in American Samoa, there appears to be a lot of opposition.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous. There are no benefits for deep sea mining for American Samoa or surrounding Pacific nations, right? Environmentally, we're going to bear all the risk and we're not going to see any of that money. Federally, there's no law to put in place to say, hey, you get this amount of royalties or revenue.
Dr. Sabrina Suluwai-Mahuka is the founder of the local environmental organization Fina Finau.
Deep sea mining is not a proven industry. And so any commercial or exploration licenses given out, our waters would be a testing ground. And we really can't afford that because our livelihoods are tied to the ocean. We're talking about sediment plumes. We're talking about, you know, normally occurring radioactive material. And all of that could affect our livelihoods.
Deep sea mining is undoubtedly a controversial topic. More than 40 countries have called for a moratorium, though some Pacific nations like Nauru and Tonga have been at the forefront of developing the industry. Scientists have warned the practice could affect fragile marine life and have far-reaching negative environmental impacts. Now, in an unprecedented move, the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has announced plans to auction off two leases covering 130,000 square kilometres of American Samoa's ocean floor for potential deep-sea mining. It foreshadowed a similar move in another U.S. Pacific territory, the Northern Mariana Islands, but is yet to announce a lease auction there. An earlier environmental assessment report of the lease areas in American Samoa said water depths range from 1,400 to 6,000 metres. The leases border the Rose Atoll National Wildlife Refuge, and Dr. Suluai Muhuka says they're not far from the Manu'u Islands.
They're also called the Sacred Islands because they're so pristine, and their folks really rely more on the health and wealth of the ocean because they can't rely on imports or a reliable port infrastructure. And so they really do depend on the ocean to feed their families. And so any impacts of deep sea mining, they would feel it first.
Also opposed to the plan is American Samoa's delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives, Aumua Amata. In a social media post, Congresswoman Amata said her opposition to deep-sea mining is long-standing, and she's confident her position represents most locals. The response from American Samoa's governor, Pula Ali'i Nikolau Pula, is more measured, despite him having opposed seabed mining in the past. In a statement, he said he's expressed clear concerns over potential environmental impacts and that the proposed lease notice is an opportunity to provide informed community input.
Should the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management ultimately decide to move forward with a lease sale, I remain steadfast in my position that any such development must be fully transparent, responsible, science-based, and carefully managed to protect our environment, safeguard our vital tuna fisheries and cultural heritage, and deliver meaningful, tangible benefits for the people of American Samoa.
The governor's been given 60 days to respond to the proposed lease notice. If it proceeds, an auction could be held in November. Dr. Sabrina Suluai Muhuka says so far the US government has ignored the views of locals. Whatever happens, she says people will not allow deep-sea mining to take place in their waters.
People are willing to stand up and say no, there will be no deep-sea mining to occur in our waters. We fall under the sovereignty of the United States, but it is under the understanding that it's a mutually beneficial relationship built on respect, and this does not benefit American Samoa at all.
And that there is American Samoan environmental activist Dr. Sabrina Suluai Muhuka, ending that report from Liam Fox.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
Cut to me landing in Tonga and showing up on my auntie's doorstep, and they had no idea I was coming. It was late at night, and they had no idea who I was. I felt the full weight of my adoption at that time.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here in the Pacific, disasters are inevitable. Floods, cyclones, tsunamis, fires, earthquakes. Whatever the disaster, if it strikes your home, there is a way you can be prepared. A go bag, a bag of essential items that could save your life in a disaster. You should pack your go bag now so that if there is a disaster, you can pick it up and go. The things you should put in it are water, food, medicine, toiletries, hand sanitizer, and a first aid kit. You should also pack a radio, blankets, protective clothing, garbage bags, a light, small tools like a knife, a can opener, and a whistle to alert emergency services. Oh, and don't forget copies of important documents. Disasters may be inevitable, but the loss of your life or your family are not. Prepare your go bag now and stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Fiji's anti-corruption watchdog is once again at the centre of public debate as two high-profile court cases raise fresh questions about accountability, justice and public confidence in key institutions. Former Deputy Prime Minister Manoa Kamikamitha is facing a perjury charge linked to evidence given during the Commission of Inquiry into FICAG. The case is one of the legal fallouts from the inquiry, which examined allegations of misconduct within the agency. At the same time, FICAG has abruptly dropped its long-running prosecution of suspended Director of Public Prosecutions, Christopher Pride. The two cases have reignited debate over the credibility and effectiveness of Fiji's anti-corruption framework. Well, Pacific scholar and political commentator Jopu Tarai from the University of the South Pacific is on the line from Suva. I say Yandara Jopu, welcome back to Pacific Beat.
To all your listeners across the region.
Thank you for your time. Now, look, Jobe, the perjury case against former Deputy Prime Minister Manoa Kamikamida, we know that it stems from evidence given during the Commission of Inquiry into FIKEC. So how significant is this prosecution? And I ask that because what does its progress then tell us about the fallout from the inquiry?
Well, I mean, in short, it's quite a messy affair, and it can be very interesting for some, frustrating for most, and certainly taxpayers will be and have been watching this for a whole variety of reasons. I think the case in itself, which again, I think is going to proceed this morning, and the outcome will provide a value judgment about the inquiry, a value judgment in the sense that of what value did it hold in terms of investigating what it had claimed to investigate, and of course the other related charges to Mr. Kamkamiva and various other particular senior politicians. So this morning and the next couple of days is going to be very interesting. Defense for Mr. Kamkamiva has filed for a no case to answer after the deliberations yesterday and the announcement from FIKEC that the or at least they have brought their case to some form of conclusion as of late yesterday. So the next couple of days is going to be interesting to see what value has the inquiry brought, especially in relation to these charges and, of course, the overall perceptions it has created.
Mm. And when we look at FIKEC, they've now withdrawn its case against suspended Director of Public Prosecutions, Christopher Pride. Again, what reasons have been given for dropping this prosecution? And what are the legal or maybe political implications of that decision?
So that's the interesting thing about that particular decision is that the reason that has been claimed is that FIKEC had been unable to serve legal papers and formal documentation to Mr. Pride, who, as you know, is in New Zealand. And so that in itself has been the stated reason. And of course, the timing and various other particular statements that have been made in between has created particular levels of just interest. But it does not stop. The interesting aspect there, it does not stop or prevent any subsequent proceedings based on the same facts. So it's somewhat still open. So it still can be taken up perhaps at a later time. So it becomes a matter of timing more so at this point.
Mm. Well, what's interesting, Jopa, is the fact that the case against Christopher Pride, you know, it's dragged on for several years. So then what impact has this long-running dispute had on public confidence in FIKEC and the Director of Public Prosecution's office?
So I think it's not so much a matter of public confidence in that regard. I think the deeper aspect to look at here, which is quite interesting, is the fact that this is a matter of design. The systems in place are operating on the basis of their design. And that links back to the Constitution. As you know, the Constitutional Review Commission is currently underway and will have to submit its final report, I think, by the end of August or maybe August, middle of August. So in many ways, the Constitution in itself is under question as well, given the way in which these particular institutions or structures are operating at times somewhat in conflict and sometimes in a way that it creates particular points of confusion or it creates a public spectacle for sure in the political landscape that we have. So I think it's more a matter of the design of the Constitution as we have it, and the reform will definitely provide greater clarity if that reform is successful.
Jopi, as you said, Constitution seems more about the Constitution being under question, the design of it. Then what about the critics, though, that argue that Pride has been able to avoid facing the courts by remaining outside of Fiji? And again, from that legal and maybe public perception standpoint, what message does that actually send? Like, does it expose weaknesses in the system?
I think it certainly does provide avenues with which people can question the systems in place. And it also, but again, you know, notwithstanding the fact that it still can be open, the proceedings can still are left open, but it does create those questions. And of course, it does eventually provide the political impetus for the reform of the Constitution in order to, in a way, make up for these particular gaps. The interesting thing here is that FIKEC officials themselves and DPP officials have gone on record publicly stating and providing reviews to the Constitution relating to ways in which, not exactly this issue, but
issues similar or related can be addressed in the structure. So it really points to the constitutional reform and addressing of those gaps in order to amend for this, because it seems like the sentiment from officials from within is that this is a problem. It has created particular levels of questions in terms of how the system is effective and efficient enough to proceed smoothly.
I don't want to sound like I'm repeating myself, but taken together, if we think about the Kamikami, the prosecution, again, the collapse of the case against Pride, have kept FICAC in the headlines. Do you think then this week's developments have either strengthened or maybe undermined, and I'm talking about public confidence in the agency, what reforms, maybe, if any, are now being called for?
That is such a good question, I have to say, even though it may sound like, as you said, you're repeating yourself. I think the call for reform, I point to nobody else than the Prime Minister himself. And this is one of the juicy bits of politics that I have pored over for the last couple of years, is that on December 6th, in 2022, I take you back to December 6th, 2022, candidate number 480, the current Prime Minister, made a statement to the effect of, we will dismantle FICAC because we have the capability in the police, DPP's office, to carry out investigations and prosecutions, end quote. That was a so-called Rambuka rapid response. Mm. The call for reform was made by the current Prime Minister himself. And not only reform, he specifically worded dismantling FICAC. Now, that was not only a talking point, that was a campaigning point. And at the time, when I was following these discourses and looking at the matrix of how much this carried, it made about 300,000 impressions on Fiji's public sphere. So that meant, and most of those that were reacting were, in terms of looking at political demographics, mostly men, mostly from the Central Division. As you know, the Central Division was one of the key voting grounds for major parties. Mm. I think the call for reform in itself had already been made by the Prime Minister. Now Prime Minister, then candidate. The question is, what happened in between to that promise from 2022, now that we're gearing up for elections in possibly late 2026 this year or early next year? So the call for reform and the issues around confidence have not only been new, it was effectively made by the current Prime Minister at that time, candidate number 480.
Goodness, interesting. As you said in the beginning, quite a bit of a messy affair. Next steps then, what are we looking at? Are we just waiting for the outcome?
Yes, well, definitely for the case and for proponents and critics alike, I would imagine opposition members will be looking at the case. But I think there's a lot we're probably not looking at the right place. The constitutional reform, I think, is where most people who would want to see particular concrete steps to be looking at, because that will really provide answers about rectifying all of these issues and the relevance of certain institutions. There are claims about duplication of prosecution resources and so forth. So it's not only this case, but of course the constitutional review and ultimately the political will of the current administration to follow through on its promise from 2022.
Mm. Jope, always great to catch up with you. Really appreciate you coming through. Some good insights there. So thank you again. Vinaka.
Vinaka.
That is Jope Tarai, Fijian political analyst and scholar at the University of the South Pacific.
Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning. Welcome back to Pacific Beat, where we head to the US now, where a Tongan American politician has won his primary election to become the first Tongan ever elected to a state senate, making history in the United States. Doug Fearfear, currently serving in the Utah House of Representatives, is set to take his seat in the Utah State Senate in November. Fearfear, a former Google employee, made tech regulation a central theme of his run, a position that recently clashed with the Trump administration, which this year helped block his state proposal requiring companies to include child safety protocols. With that, Mr. Fearfear joins us now on the line, and I say, Mano Dalmai Bongbongini, welcome to Pacific Beat.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Look, Doug, firstly, congratulations on your election. What we know of Utah is that it actually has one of the biggest Pacific Island communities in the US. I suppose as a Pacific man, how do you think this will help you serve the community as a state senator?
Yeah, I think having the perspective of a Polynesian man and a Polynesian husband, father, it gives me the ability to represent and serve the many Polynesians who reside and live in Utah. And so it gives me a perspective that I think many people on the Hill and Capitol Hill don't have. And so it also gives the opportunity for many of the Polynesians to have access to someone in government to reach out to with questions and things that they need. And so I think it goes both ways. It'll serve my perspective, but also it'll act as a lifeline and ways that I can help the Polynesian people of Utah.
Nice. And Doug, you entered Utah's House of Representatives back in 2024. And here you are. You've now made your way into the state Senate through the Republican primaries. I mean, why are you moving into the Senate?
Yeah, this allows me to represent a little bit more people and have a bigger impact. One thing, as you mentioned earlier, that's moving quickly is technology and artificial intelligence. Having come from Google and having that experience and that background is something that's lacking not only in Utah's government, but really throughout governments in the country, in the U.S., and also throughout the world. And so having that perspective is rare, and having the ability to chart the path of how we as Americans, as Utahns, as basically citizens of the earth, how we, you know, take on this new path of artificial intelligence is something that's important to me and something that I want to have a say on as I have young kids.
Yes, and before we do get into that conversation around AI, you did mention, yes, you're a former technology worker there at Google before you actually turned to politics. Love to know, what sort of made you switch to politics? Was it a natural progression for you?
I think as I saw what has transpired with social media and how it's affected kids, I have four young kids that range from the age of 4 to 13, and wanting to make sure that what we hand over to our kids and the next generation is something that we can be proud of. I wanted to have more say than just me and my household, but making sure that the technology that's being produced is something that we can trust and that we can have confidence as parents, and wanted to make sure that my kids would live in a world that they can use technology for their benefit and not tech companies or the technology working against them.
And yeah, there's this debate right now about artificial intelligence in the US and pretty much across the world. What is then your position on AI? Like, do you feel it's a force for good, or does it need to be curbed?
I think it's a tool, and it depends on how you use it. And I've always taken the position that I am pro AI. I think we can use it, and I'm pro innovation. I think it's going to solve some of the world's biggest problems. But at the same time, I also think that there's an ability to set up reasonable guardrails to ensure that it's safe for especially our kids, but other vulnerable populations like our seniors. We see a lot of fraud happening to them and people using AI to do that. And so I think setting up some guardrails to ensure that the AI can innovate and can grow and solve problems, but at the same time, it doesn't harm us as human beings.
Doug, what are the challenges then of, if we look at our community, or look at your community specifically, of being a Tongan in the US, how do you actually channel these into your role as a politician?
It's something that I think through a lot. I think the way that I was raised with family and faith being a big part of who I am, it's kind of opened up the doors to my colleagues. You know, we see each other as brothers and sisters, and I think we have the ability to cross the aisle and work with people who maybe see things differently than us. And I think having that Polynesian friendly kindness is setting the example that we can disagree on policy and we can disagree on things, but that doesn't mean we have to hate each other. And I think that kind of ofa or that Tongan background has taught me that we can love each other and disagree, and that's okay.
Well, the thing was, I heard you were recently back in Tonga, and you were able to meet with the Deputy Prime Minister. So does that speak of you still having quite strong connection with the homeland?
Absolutely. Still have family there. We try to travel back, you know, every 2 to 3 years. I think it's important for my kids to see where their family comes from, where their blood and their roots started and all began. And it's important to show them kind of their heritage and to something to be proud of. And it was an honor to meet with the Deputy Prime Minister and to talk about how we can continue to partner and collaborate, how we can get Tongan business owners to invest in economic development in the islands of Tonga. And so it was a great meeting, and it was an honor to represent kind of an official from America. But I think there's much more opportunity for us to work and collaborate together.
Beautiful. Doug, look, I have to ask, though, the next presidential election, it is in 2028. I know the Republican Party needs a candidate. Do you think you'd raise your hand for being the U.S. president?
No, I think I'm far from that. Getting into politics, I wanted to make a difference. And in my local community, I think I appreciate the question, but I think I see myself working best in the state of Utah and influencing the people of Utah. I think that's maybe a goal for the next generation.
So that's a yes or a no?
Yes. I think it's a no. And I hope that at least me getting involved in politics will help the next generation see that there's possibilities to even run for the highest office in America.
Of course. And I think that's the greatest thing, that we've been able to speak to someone who's taken that step. And Doug, I just want to say, Malo Apito, really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing.
Malo Apito, thank you so much. Have
no
a good worries. One.
You too. That is Doug Fearfear, Utah State Representative and the Republican nominee for Utah State Senate. Now, he will take that Senate seat on November the 3rd. Pacific Beat. To sport now, where the rising stars of soccer in Fiji have done it again, with the baby Bulla Boys winning a place at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup for the third year in a row. They secured their spot in Qatar by defeating Solomon Islands on penalties after their OFC Under-16 Championship semi-final in PNG ended in a 0-0 draw. In the second semi-final, New Zealand were made to battle hard by the host nation before winning the match 3-0 to earn their World Cup spot. So now the junior All-Whites will go head-to-head with Fiji on Saturday in the OFC Championship Final. Joining us from Port Moresby is Fiji's head coach, Sunil Kumar. With that, I say, Yandra, Sunil.
Yandra.
Thank you for joining us. Hey, I have to say, congratulations on your World Cup hat-trick. What does this say about how soccer is developing in Fiji?
Thank you. I think this is a clear indication that there's development going on in Fiji, and there are a lot of young talents out there in Fiji who are ready to represent the country, and also the future of the country is bright.
Mm. So, Sunil, just like 12 months ago, you know, you have two World Cups to plan for, this year's and next. Despite the age restrictions, you must have a pretty large pool of players to choose from now. Is that the case?
Yes, actually, this gives other players also who are not part of the squad here to also an opportunity to get a spot for the World Cup, because the World Cup is next year, and then all the players have to fight for a spot. So that allows the pool to get bigger as well. And then there's school competition going on in Fiji. There's Fiji FAE youth competitions. And there are also players out there in overseas who has eligibility to represent Fiji. So, yeah, this gives an opportunity to, I think, even make the pool bigger.
Mm. And I want to ask, what did you learn from the 2025 World Cup that you think can help the team at the next two tournaments and maybe, let's hope, perhaps secure a first win?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I think for us to go and first of all experience the World Cup, and the environment at the World Cup is totally different, and the level of the competition at the World Cup is totally different from the games here at OFC Oceania level, and what our players are exposed to here in Oceania. But yes, first of all, qualifying is an achievement for us and for Fiji. We have done it for the third time, and it's an achievement for us. And at the World Cup, I would say, like, the intensity of the game is really high. The quality of players, both technically and tactically, they are like top players. and physically also like really matured players. So yeah, these are some of the learnings for us going into our next World Cup and the third one as well. Like every year, the World Cup qualifiers here in Oceania is very competitive. And I would say like even this year was a really competitive competition because FIFA is also investing a lot on youth and talent development. And they're sending coaches, expertise across to countries, especially here in Oceania. And if you look at our friends out here in Oceania, like Solomon, Vanuatu, and so many countries out here, they have a lot of expertise. FIFA talent development scheme has been injected into countries. So that is pushing the level, the benchmark of the competition really high. And you see the competition here is really competitive.
Sunil, we come back to the OFC final though. You know, New Zealand are always the favourites, it seems, but your team has yet to concede a goal. So you must believe you have a chance of winning the title.
Yeah, well, one of our goals before we came into this tournament was a clean sheet. And so far, the players are keeping it that way. So we have not conceded any goals. So that's one of our key strengths, I would say. And going to the final, we always know New Zealand is the favourite. And this time again, they are the favourite. So we are happy to go into the final as underdogs and just put up a fight against New Zealand in the final. And it's a game of 90 minutes. So
That's right.
To the boys, we have said, let's put up a fight against New Zealand.
Absolutely. And look, Sunil, we really appreciate you coming on the show this morning. Wishing you all the best with the boys there for that final game.
Thank you so much, Naka.
Thank you. That is Sunil Kumar, head coach of the Baby Bulla Boys, Fiji's under-16 soccer team, on the line from Port Moresby.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
All right, Taiwan is considering reviewing its economic ties with Papua New Guinea, potentially threatening a third of PNG's gas exports. It comes after PNG announced the closure of Taipei's office in Port Moresby in a move consistent with its One China policy. Now, the Taipei Times reports that Taiwan's foreign ministry convened a meeting to discuss potential responses, which includes reviewing its LNG purchases from PNG. However, Andrew Antomako, a visiting lecturer to the UPNG School of Business and Public Policy, told Carl Evans cutting trade ties might hurt Taiwan more than it will PNG.
PNG LNG produces 6.6 million tons of LNG every year, so of which Taiwan buys 1.2 million tons, which is about 18% of PNG's LNG total annual production, and China buys 2 million tons, which is about 30%, and also Japan buys 3.3 million tons, which is about 50%.
Interesting. So 1.2 million, that is a bit of a chunk. So if Taiwan do go ahead and sort of reevaluate that deal and potentially stop buying from PNG, what impact would that loss have on PNG's economy?
Yeah, so the PNG LNG project is an important project in PNG's economy. PNG owns a 19.4% stake in the PNG LNG project. The project pays dividends to the state, provincial governments, landowners, as well as royalties, taxes, and other benefits each year. So official reports confirm that the PNG LNG project has delivered about more than 34 billion kina since production, which is about $8 billion. So the impact will be quite sizable to the economy.
Yeah, well, I guess that brings us to the next question as to why, you know, PNG made the decision they made. If global trade conditions for LNG are already uncertain due to the Iran war, why do you think PNG did this when demand for gas right now is so high?
Yeah, so I'm not privy as to why PNG government decided to close down Taiwan's diplomatic office in Port Moresby, as Taiwan has been an important development partner to PNG for many years, going back early 1990s. And now we hear that Taiwan is assessing or reviewing its LNG imports from PNG and the LNG project. But given the turmoil and uncertainty in the global energy supply and the market, it doesn't help both parties if Taiwan decides to stop buying LNG from PNG LNG project. While it will affect about 18% of PNG LNG export, it will also affect Taiwan's supply of LNG, because PNG LNG is the fourth largest supplier of LNG to Taiwan, and it accounts for about 14.3% of total Taiwan's LNG need. Further, PNG LNG and Taiwan have a 20-year sale and purchase agreement, and which lasts until 2033. So importantly, the current global situation, the global energy market is affected more by supply shock due to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. So I would think it would affect Taiwan more than PNG in this situation.
So if PNG were to lose the Taiwanese market, do you think it would be easy for the Papua New Guinean government to find a new market to sell to?
I think so, because PNG LNG exports do not go through to the Strait of Hormuz, so I would think PNG would find a new buyers or market easily. When we balance things out economically, on the economic front, I think Taiwan may lose out on the, you know, so PNG may be able to find buyers easily.
And that there is Andrew Antomako, visiting lecturer to the UPNG School of Business and Public Policy and the project coordinator of the ANU and PNG partnership. He was speaking there with Carl Evans. Now to the Solomon Islands, where breast, prostate and cervical cancers are amongst the most common forms of the disease. Now, many people don't seek medical help until the cancer is already at an advanced stage. And with limited specialist services available, treatment can be hard to access. But the country's first and only oncologist, Dr. Andrew Sommer, is helping change that. Through the Cancer Services Unit, he's working to ensure more patients can get the life-saving chemotherapy they need. I spoke to him earlier on his fight to see his community have better access to diagnoses and treatment.
Happy to be of a good oncology service to the country. I'm proud of doing well for our people.
I was wondering, how was the care then before you became the first and only oncologist?
Actually not well treated and followed up, because the protocols were old and the drugs were like out of date, and then they do not concentrate on the patients. They just rely, if the patient comes to take a treatment, the patient comes. If it doesn't come, they don't even worry about following them up. So it's not well treated. And the room they give chemotherapy in, that, you know, they dress the diabetic wounds in there, and then it comes out, and then they go and give chemo in there. So quite unhygienic here. So now that we have a proper place to do the chemotherapy, more hygiene, and also our staff are trained as well, so we know how to treat our patients. That's quite a big difference from the first time.
What are some of the actual most common cancers you're seeing in Solomon Islands?
We have breast the first, followed by prostate second, and then cervix the third at the moment in the Solomon. We have mouth, head and neck cancers and all these after. Usually we see them late. That's the usual trend we see.
You know, the oncology unit, it was established back in 2017. How far have you seen the unit come since then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have developed a lot, actually, from having no unit to having an oncology unit in 2018. And then we've developed into getting new drugs.
So we started off with myself and two nurses. Now we have like four doctors, myself and three registrars, and we have six nurses. And we've also introduced a lot of new drugs into the national drugs and therapeutic committee have approved a few more newer drugs.
Do you think it'll make a difference now that you have this unit for early screening?
Yes, we do. Because of the increased
high number of breast cancer,
we have a mammogram machine
sponsored by the Solomon Island Maritime Authority, done a lot of awareness programs.
So that actually has helped in women,
so men coming into screening.
But as the country's only oncologist, how do you manage the emotional weight for caring for so many patients?
Yes, that has come quite... I didn't expect it, but as I go along, it is quite a heavy, I will say, heavy load for me to carry. And that, you know, a lot of people come in, they've come in the late stages, so it's quite a emotional thing to do. I mean, explaining condition to patients and,
Yeah, emotional stress as well.
But by having a couple of registrars, it slowly relieves the tension and the stress.
Well, do you see hope that in the coming years that there will be more Solomon Islanders who will be trained, you know, in oncology and cancer care, you know, so that the workload doesn't fall on just yourself, really?
Yes, yes. I'm looking forward to that, and I'm hopeful. I'm working towards it. With the help of John James Foundation in Australia, they've sponsored another oncologist, one of my registrars. She will start in October, term 4. So there's another one now in the vicinity starting the training. So I'm getting excited.
Doctor, I understand that the Cancer Sciences Unit had received a very prestigious international award for the Association for Medical Education in Europe. What does that actually mean to you and the team there?
We are also proud that they've taken that award. It means that the guys that then trained us are very well recognized in the world.
I want to come back to, you know, those that you look after. Prevention is often, you know, just as important as treatment. But what lifestyle changes or public health measures do you think could reduce the cancer burden there in the Solomon Islands?
I think lifestyle and food, that's the main cause in the Solomon Islands. And it comes especially because of some economic problems. People can't afford good food, healthy foods, because we have all the foods on the shop which are not very healthy. Those are the ones which are cheap, you know, and people don't do exercise. They rely on buses, cars to go to work and move around. And the other thing that we also realize is education. We do a lot of awareness, mostly in Honiara only, but, you know, the whole of the country needs awareness. And there's another big issue which we face here, which contributes a lot to the late presentation. It's the traditional medicine. So people go to the traditional healers or, you know, the witch doctor first before they even come to medical institutions. They give them all this and tell them, oh, this herb will heal you, this witchcraft thing will heal you. And then by the time they know it's already spread, that's when they come to the hospital. That's a very common scene we see. It's quite hard because, you know, the country is, you know, 70% of the people live in the villages, and that's all they know.
Well, then what do you hope or look ahead to maybe 5-10 years from now, like your vision for cancer care in the Solomon Islands?
First of all, improving our infrastructure. It's run down. It's a couple of weeks ago, some of the posts broke. We have to move out, I mean, increase and train all our staff. And then from there, we can move on to improving drugs and do a lot of our education and awareness so that people come early, then we can treat them early, and then they get cured. Because it's burden for our country to, you know, keep treating people with, you know, advanced cancers.
And that is Dr. Andrew Sommer, first and only oncologist at the National Referral Hospital in Honiara. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Now, the bodies of two women have been recovered from the sinking of a boat off of East New Britain over the weekend. 25 others remain missing at sea.
A boy found her. They bring her to the council's residence. They kept her for a night. Since here in Zawl Island, we don't have a network in the night. So they kept her till in the morning, and they rang up to the disaster office. So the chopper went down and got her.
Now, you can find that story and others when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Remember, we are across our socials. You can check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Our team will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You'll have your beautiful host, Chris Narita Amanuliang from Solomon Islands. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, Odua Afaatum. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.